Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Lauer Editorial Review. The Lauer is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Lauer is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Lauer and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Lauer and Editorial Review, please visit our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Lauer and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on turning the world upside down when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our forefathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. And you shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention followed that scriptural principle of law back in 1787 when they put into our Constitution, in that Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But back in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation, and now in place of these just weights and balances. These two presidents have introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They've given us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coin. And now in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School. We conduct that school here at the law school twice a year. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Well, turning the world upside down is a scripture. It actually comes from Acts 17, verse 6. And the story goes something like this. "The Jews, which believed not, moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of a baser sort. And they gathered a company, and they set all of the city at an uproar. And they assaulted the house of Jason, and they sought to bring them out to the people. And when they found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, 'These that have turned the world upside down are come hither also.'" Now, what do they mean, he turned the world upside down? Remember, these were the disciples. This is Paul and Barnabas, Peter, Paul, James, and John are being talked about here. They're going around telling a story. They're telling a story about the Messiah. They're telling a story about the Ten Commandments and the law of God. And these fellows thought that they were turning the world upside down. The Apostle Paul probably would have thought, no, I'm trying to turn the world right side up. It's a matter of your perspective as to whether somebody's turning the world upside down. I mean, if somebody's telling you something that's diametrically opposite from what you believe, they're turning the world upside down. That guy, from his point of view, he's saying to himself, "Well, no, I'm trying to straighten you out, partner. I'm trying to turn the world right side up." Well, I got a letter from a lady, a Seventh-day Adventist lady, and I'd done a series of programs, you know, on the two penal clause chapters here in the Bible. It's Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And she tuned me up in no uncertain terms, and she said, the gist of her letter was, she said that the God that she served would never do such a thing. So I wrote her letter back, this is my custom, and I told her, "Well, lady, that's probably true. I certainly wouldn't want to get in the way of you and your God. But I didn't come here to report on your God. I came here to report on the God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he's a guy that has done this in the past, is prepared to do it now, and he says he's going to do it in the future. So I thought that that was more newsworthy than the average run-of-the-mill gods that we're all familiar with, you know, the gods of Moonday and Tuesday and Thursday and Sunday and Saturn and Jupiter and Mars. You know, we're pretty familiar with all those gods, Allah, Buddha, Jesus. But there's another God out here that most of us haven't heard very much about, and he's not reported on in the press. Katie Couric doesn't report on him. Brian Williams doesn't report on him. And Billy Graham, Oral Roberts, Jerry Falwell, and the great televangelist, you know, Pat Robertson, they don't report on this guy. So I thought, shucks, maybe I could pull a scoop together here, as they say in the news business. Do a scoop and put a story together here that maybe you'd never heard before. So if that's shocking to you, let me read to you from the International Forecaster. This is put out, by the way, by a fellow named Bob Chapman. Now, Bob Chapman's an old man. He's old and full of years. He has been reporting on the markets and the stock market and the economic news for 50 years. He was an old-timey stockbroker. He was a spook in the Army. I mean, he's pretty well connected, and he's got good connections in Congress and around the world, and he's a conservative. He's a crazy lunatic, right-wing radical fanatic, you know, like a lot of us are. Anyway, he puts out a newsletter. It's called International Forecaster. And my experience has been this. A student comes in, and I say, do you subscribe to any of the newsletters? And they look at you like, huh? I get USA Today. I watch Katie Couric. And then I say, have you ever read the International Forecaster or the Money Changer or Don McIlvaney or Gary North? Anybody, you know, that has something intelligent to say? And they look at you like, no, never have. So I oftentimes will give them a sample copy, and I say, here, take this back to your motel tonight and read this and see what you think. Next day, they'll come back, and I'll say, did you read the Forecaster? Well, I didn't read it all. Well, how much of it do you read? Well, I read 5 pages. Now, this International Forecaster is about 20 pages, comes out twice a week. And it's pretty factual. It's well documented. The guy says, well, let me cite from the sources that I'm giving you this information from. Most of it's pretty public. You know, you can get it from the U.S. Government Printing Office. You can get it from the Department of Labor. These statistics and analysis, you know, of the various markets, you know, are published every day, the stock market, the gold market, the silver markets. And so he's reporting on a story here on the adjustable rate mortgages. And the reason that these people can only read about 5 pages is because the truth is so shocking, it is so discomforting, that after about 5 pages, most people's minds turn off. They just can't handle it. It's kind of like this Adventist lady. If you were to read the Bible, just factually pick it up and read it, it would just scare the living hell out of you, and you can't handle it. And that's why most people don't read the Bible. Most people have actually picked it up and tried to read it, and they'll read 4 or 5 chapters, you know, maybe in the book of 1st and 2nd Kings or something like that, and it just scares the living hell out of them. And so they put it down. They never pick it up again. That's something for preachers and pastors and sky pilots and holy joes to pick up and read and tell us what it says. It isn't anything new. It was very common. The people came to Moses after they had heard God live and direct speaking from the mountain. You'll see this in Exodus 19:16 through Exodus 24, verse 7. And the people said, this is the old covenant contract. And God, you know, he's not bashful at all. And this God isn't. I can't speak for all the gods out there, but this particular God, the God of Abraham, God of Moses, he's not bashful God at all. He gets right out there, and he talks, and he speaks, and he's got a heavy-duty voice. And if you're going to talk to 3 million people down at the bottom of a 6,000-foot mountain, you know, you got to raise your voice a little bit. And so he did, and he just scared the living hell out of everybody. And so they came to Moses, and they said, hey, Moses, you go up and you tell that God now, turn it off, turn it down. Because we're all going to tune out, and we're bummed out about this. We don't want this God talking to us anymore. You go up there and you talk to him. You come back and report to us. And this was the beginning of representative government here in the nations of Israel. It wasn't that our God couldn't talk to us. It's that we couldn't listen to what he had to say. And that was what the real problem was. So Moses said, "Well, okay, I'll go up and talk to him." And he did, and they came to an agreement. And so they came down, and reported to the people. Well, the people have well spoken. God will talk to Moses. Moses will come down and talk to you, and you'll have representative government. We won't have direct government. We'll have representative government. And we've had that, you know, by and large ever since. Well, anyway, getting back to this lady over here, she said that she doesn't serve this God. She's got a different God over there, and that's one of our problems. One of our problems. But before I get into what the problems are, listen to this story. Just one paragraph. I won't bury you here with 20 pages. I'm just going to read to you a paragraph from Bob Chapman and illustrate my point that when you get through listening to this guy, he's going to scare the hell out of you, and you can't handle that. Most Americans, and I suppose most of you Canadians and Australians are in the same boat, most of you Europeans can't handle this. Israelites can't handle hard-to-be-understood news. Anyway, here's Chapman. He says, these are the main areas where the financial engineers grossly underestimated the potential for trouble that might cause their derivative creations to fail. These three factors all feed on one another and are going to whip up a storm powerful enough to propel the United States and large parts of the world into the greatest economic depression of all time. Well, here's the D word. I mean, you know, talk about the F word and the N word and the R word. Here comes the D word. This is the greatest economic depression of all times. Now, as a businessman, I look at this as opportunity. I don't know how you see it, but some of the greatest fortunes ever amassed were amassed during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Well, they weren't made in stocks and bonds, but you know, there's other things besides stocks and bonds to make money at. I don't know if the rest of you had ever heard of anything like that, but there's other ways to make money besides stocks and bonds. Now, he goes on, here's the kicker. He says, now here's an example of how these three factors, as well as other factors, feed on one another under the current scenario. The unaffordable rate resets on the adjustable rate mortgages and declining home values encourage mortgage defaults and erode collateral reserves on mortgage-backed derivatives.
This in turn leads to asset devaluations and resulting bank insolvencies, as well as a tightening of credit and increases in interest rates to remove risk and to compensate for increased risk, respectively, which in turn leads to a decrease in demand for homes due to fewer qualified buyers and higher loan costs, which prevents current homeowners from trading up, which causes declines in the home building and employment in the building trades and in businesses that benefit from the home building business, which in turn then reduces wages and consumer demand, which then fuels recessionary forces, which in turn causes the Fed to lower interest rates and expand money and credit to avoid a recession, which in turn fuels inflation as the money supply expands exponentially, which further erodes real wages and consumer spending, which further reduces the demand for housing and the number of qualified buyers, and then which further fuels the recession and erodes real estate values, causing the Fed to expand the money supply and credit and to lower rates even more. This then results in ever greater inflation to the point where the Fed must raise rates to stop us from becoming the next Weimar Republic, which increases the cost of doing business and decimates corporate profits while increasing the cost of owning a home and causes further price reductions for real estate, which decreases demand for real estate, increases loan defaults, and further fuels the ever-deepening recession, which causes the stock markets to crash and burn, and on and on and on ad nauseum. And that's the end of the sentence. And this is where we're headed. And until the failures are allowed to happen and the system is purged, it will only continue to get worse. And the longer and the harder the Fed tries to prevent a recession, the longer and deeper the resulting depression. And if the Fed tries to put all of these losses onto the backs of the taxpayers, this will ignite hyperinflation, and the whole country will implode like the Weimar Republic did, and there will be a revolution, which the Illuminists will not survive. They have completely blown their plans. Their own greed and hunger for power has destroyed them. All right, now let's just analyze that for a minute, because that's pretty heavy duty paragraph. And Bob Chapman, he's been around for a while. I kind of respect the guy because he's been on point for years and years. You know, I've been watching, paying attention to what he has to say. And, you know, when he said that the housing market has peaked or is going to peak in 2005, he hit the nail just about on the head. And it peaked. And then he said, now you need to get out of stocks. You need to get out of real estate. And, you know, those of us that did, we prospered. And those that didn't are sitting there pulling their hair out and scratching their butts and wondering, well, what happened? We don't know. Can't figure it out. And of course, a lot of you write me letters and you say, well, what should I do next? As if I'm a prophet and I'm directly connected with God and I'm supposed to pass on to you the greatest and the newest revelations from God to save your bacon. And that's really not my role in life, so I thought I'd point that out to you. But this guy, Chapman, now has given us some bad news. And this is why people can only read about 4 or 5 pages of this and then their eyes glaze over and they put it down. And when they come back to class, they say, well, did you read the forecaster yesterday? Did you learn anything? And they kind of, well, I read 4 or 5 pages. And that's about as far as I can get. Sometimes they'll say, well, it's economic, and I'm not too good on economics. There wasn't anything in there about economics. He's talking about depression. He's talking about what fuels, what causes this problem to start with, and it's this phony paper money. And so all the economists and all the politicians are out here pulling their hair out, and they're talking and they're jawboning. The president the other day said, well, what we need is a stimulus package. We're going to send all of you people $600. You're going to send me $600 to stimulate the economy. And so that's against the law to take that $600. I'll point that out to you. One of our problems in life is that we're unable to recognize what the problem is. And so we're out here trying to solve a problem. We don't even understand what the hell the problem is. The problem is the paper money that caused this to start with. If we were using just weights and balances, gold and silver coin, we wouldn't have this problem to start with. But, you know, we decided back in 1913 we needed a central bank. And so, okay, now we got a central bank. I'm not here arguing with you people over your central bank. I don't use it. But, you know, if you want to use it, go ahead and do that. But there's a result that comes from that. It's a punishment is what it is. It's a punishment. See, our God gave us a law that says, thou shalt not steal. And then it's supported by a statute that says, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Our founding fathers followed that. And they put into our Constitution, you know, Article 1, Section 10 says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. It was obvious by 1913 that our founding fathers and God did not understand economics. And so a guy by the name of Paul Warburg came over here in 1907, started lobbying for a central bank in the United States. Now, from 1787 to 1907, we became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world in 120 years. And I don't know what the hell we needed a central bank for. We didn't have one for 120 years, became the richest kids on the block. All of a sudden, Warburg comes along and says, hey, you know, we got to have this central bank. And so the people said, yeah, that's right. We need a central bank over here. God didn't know what he was talking about, and the founding fathers were spaced out on something. And so you people approved this central bank long before I was born. By 1930, the thing had gone insolvent. Well, it went bankrupt. It bankrupted the United States. That's what the Great Depression is. That's what a national bankruptcy is. It's a Great Depression. It's where the nation can't meet the people of a nation. Great. It just happened the other day down in Argentina. These people, they got strung out and they couldn't make their payments. So their creditors put them on COD. It happens to people. And a lot of you people out there, it's happening to. When you can't make the payments on your house, they're going to come take your house away. When you don't make the payments on your car, they come take your car away. They don't make your payments on your bank cards, they come take your bank cards away from you, and then they put a lien on your paycheck and sue you, and they just do all kinds of crazy things and trying to get their money. And then, you know, to counterbalance that, maybe you file for bankruptcy. See? Well, this lady now, remember, she comes along and says, the God that I serve would never do this. Well, it's being done. You know, you take Hurricane Katrina, you know, that was a punishment that that we Americans received. And not just you people down on the Gulf Coast. You know, you people down there got your houses knocked down. Our punishment out here in Seattle, Washington is we get to pay for it. You get your house knocked down, you lost your pictures and you lost your car and one thing or another. And the rest of us out here, we got to come in with our taxpayer dollars and rebuild your house. I don't know why we're doing that, but that's what they told us. Well, I guess it's because we practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. Well, this guy, Paul, the apostle, wasn't a Christian. See, I hear this all the time, you know, that all these Christians, they run around, and this lady is a Christian. She's a Seventh-day Adventist. And the Christians, they have a different view of the Bible than the Bible has of itself. And so they call themselves Christians, and they call Jesus a Christian. Jesus wasn't even his name. His name was Emmanuel. I don't know if you people knew that or understood that, but Jesus Christ was not the Messiah's name. His name is revealed here. It's in Matthew chapter 1, I believe it is. And the angel came and said, his name shall be called Emmanuel. See if I can find that. It's got to be here somewhere. Yeah, Matthew chapter 1. I thought I had it written in my notes here. Let me see if I do. Name here. Called his name, Jeremiah, Isaiah. Yeah, here it is. It's in Isaiah 7, verse 14. And Isaiah, who is a prophet, said his name shall be called Emmanuel. So if you look in Isaiah 7, verse 14, it says his name is Emmanuel. And then in Matthew 1, verse 23, I'll just read it to you. I turned to it, so let me read it. It says, behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. So, you know, the people, they run around calling him Jesus. Now, well, let me ask you this. Let's suppose that, just for the sake of our discussion, you came up to me and you said, well, my name is Bob Chapman. And I said, oh, so pleased to meet you, Johnson, Jeb Johnson. And you say, no, my name is Bob Chapman. I said, no, it's Jeb Johnson. I know better. Typically, when somebody tells you what his name is, you know, you don't say to the guy, well, I think you're a lying sack of you-know-what, so therefore produce your birth certificate and prove to me that your name is Bob Chapman. Otherwise, I'm going to call you Jeb Johnson. You know, normally we take people at their word. And so here you look in the Bible and you want to know what the Messiah's name is. It says his name is Emmanuel and we call him Jesus Christ. I don't know what the hell that's all about, but that's theology. That's religion. That's the way life is. Doesn't make any sense. I've never seen any sense come out of Christian philosophy. I've been around for 70 years and I haven't seen any yet. If you can point to one point in Christian philosophy that makes any rational sense, would you please tell me what that is? Hell, I'll put it on the air. One, not 50, just one common sense, rational point in Christian philosophy. I'd like to know what the hell it is. We can't even get this guy's name right. So what chance have you got, lady, of ever understanding what the scripture has to say if you can't even get the guy's name? When he comes up and says, my name is Emmanuel, we say, oh, no, that's a lie. We don't believe it for a moment. We think your name is Jesus. And so the Christians, from that point on, they took the Bible and then they've changed it a lot. You know, every place where where God's name is in here, they put in Lord or they put in Jesus or Christ or something else. You know, they've got names, Jehovah, one thing or another. They've got names, you know. So now somebody comes along and says, did you know that? And I'm sure you're sitting there saying, my God, this guy Gordon is turning the world upside down, which is where we started this discussion, remember? That's exactly what the Jews said about Peter, Paul, James, and John, and Paul and all these guys. They said, hey, you know, you guys are over here disrupting the status quo. You guys are out here reporting on things we don't want to hear. I mean, we already know the answers, and you guys come along over here giving us different questions, and we don't like that. So I said to you that the Apostle Paul was not a Christian. And right away, you know, people say, well, you know, if you were Judy Hartson, you'd gasp, and then go report me to Mr. Witt. Of course, when I was in fifth grade, I didn't know Paul wasn't a Christian. I thought he was a Christian because that's what everybody was telling me. But the Apostle Paul, he actually had something to say about that himself. I mean, he could walk, talk, and chew gum all by himself. This guy, Paul. He was a prosecuting attorney, come to find out. I don't know if you knew that or not. That's right. The Apostle Paul was a prosecuting attorney, probably in his 40s. So I'll give you a little hope, all you prosecutors out there. But over in a little letter here called Philippians chapter 3, verse 5. This Paul is telling a little story over here, and I'll just give you a little context. It says, "Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord to write the same things to you. To me, indeed, is not grievous, but for you it is safe. Beware of dogs." You know what a dog is? It's a sodomite. Beware of sodomites. Beware of evil workers. Beware of the concision. For we are the circumcision, which worship God in the Spirit and rejoice in Jesus Christ and have no confidence in the flesh. Though I might also have confidence in the flesh, if any other man thinketh that he hath, whereof he might trust in the flesh, I more. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. Now here's the Apostle Paul. He had the greatest opportunity in the world to say, now listen, circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Christian, as touching the law, I was a Pharisee, but now I'm a Christian. He didn't say that. He said he was a Hebrew, and he said he was a Hebrew of the Hebrews and circumcised the eighth day. And this word Christian appears in the Bible three times. Three times. And do you know that all three times that it's mentioned in the Bible, it is the enemies of these people who are accusing them or calling them Christians? Kind of like people do me every once in a while. They call me a tax protester, or they call me a constitutionalist. You know, they kind of throw it out with invective. They say, are you one of those constitutionalists? I met a guy out in California one time. I think he was a sodomite. There's a word here, you know, if you're afraid of sodomites, they call them homophobics. And the guy said, are you one of those homophobics? Hell, I didn't even know what a homophobic was. I'd asked my wife, I said, what the hell is a homophobic? I thought it maybe had something to do with a hemophiliac or something like that, a bleeder or something, you know, kind of sounded the same, you know, but... No, I said, that's some guy that's opposed to sodomites or something like that. And I said, well, what do you know about that? Hey, listen, I got to give you a reminder here. We're talking about turning the world upside down. So let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed at the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order one, just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Hey, we're talking about turning the world upside down. It's in Acts 17, verse 6. If you go out here and you tell somebody something that is uncomfortable, scary, you know, like the Great Depression of the 1930s is about to be revisited upon us, you know, that scares people. They really don't want to hear that. And so, you know, if you want to be popular, you know, you need to tell people what they want to hear. Well, I'm an old-timey salesman. I understand that. But I'm not here to sell you anything, so I'm just here to scare the hell out of you. So, you know, if you don't like it, turn the dial. If it's scary, you shouldn't listen to things like this. Go listen to rock and roll. Now, for the other two or three of you out there, I said that Paul was not a Christian, and I cited Philippians 3, verse 5. And I'm pointing out here that if this guy Paul was a Christian, And if he wanted to promote Christianity, this was his opportunity to say, hey, look, I'm a Christian. Number me with the Christians. He doesn't. He says, I'm a Hebrew, and I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrew. Well, I picked up on that, and I've often wondered about why you people out there call yourselves Christians. You know, Christians are criminals. Christians are criminals, pure and simple. And if you want to know why this Great Depression is about to come down around our heads, it's because of our criminal behavior. It's because of the cause and effect relationship that comes from bad economics. Now, there's an economic system that's outlined here in the Bible, and it's called, thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag, and don't practice usury and interest. Christians practice unjust weights and balances. Christians are thieves. And then on top of that, they practice usury and interest. And all you Christians out there have mortgages on your houses, and you're paying interest on your cars and your consumer debts and your credit cards, and you don't practice thou shalt not commit usury. Don't practice usury. And so when I come along and I point that out, well, I'm some kind of an antichrist, and I don't fit in with your clique, and so therefore, you know, I must be a badass, and so we're not going to listen to that crazy lunatic. Well, that's why I told you, turn the dial. You know, I listen to something that's discomforting, do you? But then, that's not newsworthy. Now, what is newsworthy is to get to a story that you haven't heard before, and something that maybe you didn't know. So I thought, well, let's pick this up today. Let's take a look at Christians in Acts 11:26, since we're close to the book of Acts here. Philippians, if you were following along, is a little bit past Acts, so you back up to Acts 11, verse 26, and you'll see the first place in the Bible where the word Christian appears. And here's what it says. It says, and when he had found him, he brought him unto Antioch, and it came to pass that a whole year they assembled themselves with the church and taught much people. And the disciples were called Christians first in Antioch. Notice they were called. Notice they didn't call themselves Christians. They were called Christians in Antioch first by the people who were there. Well, it makes all the sense in the world. If you look back, you know, Christians were around long before Jesus. Did you know that? And that's because the Christians are the worshipers of Christos. Christos, spelled with a K. And Christos is the Indian sun god. People have been worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars, you know, for thousands of years. And so the Indians, they were worshiping Christos, and they were called Christians. Well, these little sects, you know, that we have them today, you know, you have Rosicrucians. Rosicrucians have been around for a long time. And they've been worshiping the sun. They're sun worshippers. And there are Mithra worshippers, and then there are witches and warlocks, and they worship the sun, and they worship witches and worship Satan and so on. And you've got all these various and sundry religions around here. And so these guys, you know, blew out of town one day. This is the guys that we commonly call Christians, you know, Peter, Paul, James, and John. And come to find out, well, I never called myself a constitutionalist, but every once in a while I'll read someplace that somebody says, that Gordon's one of those constitutionalists. Well, I've never been opposed to the Constitution. I thought it was a pretty good document, and I thought it was all right until, you know, somebody asked me, are you one of those constitutionalists? You know, kind of like, are you one of those sodomites? In a derogatory sort of way. You know, and I thought, well, I didn't know that it was, or that I should be held in derision because I believe and practice the Constitution of my country. But for some reason, my fellow countrymen sometimes point, especially public officials, especially policemen. I mean, policemen, they just hate the Constitution, and they hate everything it stands for. I've never met one yet that had a good word for the Constitution. Well, I guess I should. Jack McLam is an exception to that rule. Jack is a constitutionalist. But other than Jack McLam and a couple of three other policemen, you know, that have broken the mold, most policemen, you know, when you assert constitutional rights, you know, they just hate you. Well, anyway, that's what we're seeing here in Acts 11, verse 26. Now, it's mentioned a second time over here. Paul was on trial. It's in Acts 26, verse 28. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, you know, almost you persuade me to be a Christian. Now, at first blush, you know, you'd read that and you'd say, well, you know, Paul must have been a Christian because Agrippa said, you know, you almost persuade me to be a Christian. You know, I could say the same thing. You know, you almost persuade me to become a Muslim. Well, let's suppose that you and I are having a conversation. And I made this statement. And I said, well, Bob, you know, you almost persuade me to become a Buddhist. Does that show then that you must be a Buddhist? Well, it would indicate that. I don't deny that, but, you know, just ask yourself this question. Are you a Buddhist? And if I ask you the question, or if I made the statement, well, Bob, you almost persuade me to be a Muslim. Bob, you almost persuade me to be a Buddhist. Bob, you almost persuade me to be a Catholic. Does that mean that you're a Catholic? Does that mean you're a Buddhist? Does that mean you're a Muslim? And I already showed you that Paul said he was a Hebrew when he had the opportunity to tell everybody about his Christian beliefs and his Christian practices over here. Now, I've talked to more than one person and said, well, I am a Christian. I got a letter in here the other day, an email from a guy, and he said, well, I am a Bible-believing Southern Baptist Christian. Well, okay. Now we know where his politics are. I don't call myself a Christian because Christians are criminals. I don't call myself a drug addict because I'm not a druggie. I don't call myself a Christian because I'm not a Christian. I don't call myself a Buddhist because I'm not a Buddhist. I don't call myself a Muslim because I'm not one of those. I don't call myself a Republican because I don't vote Republican. I don't call myself a Democrat because I don't vote Democratic. And I don't call myself a communist because I don't practice communism. I mean, there's a lot of things that I'm not. And I'm called a lot of things. One more place over here in Peter, 1 Peter 4:16, I believe it is. Get my notes out here again. Yeah, here. 1 Peter 4:16. Now, here's a little better argument for Christianity and Christians in 1 Peter 4:16. It doesn't hold up, but it would be a better argument for him. Talking about Christians over here, you know, who are the Christians? It says here, yet if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. Now, right away you'd say, well, see, Peter must have been a Christian because it says here, yet if any man suffer as a Christian. What if I said, well, if any of you people suffer as a victim of Hurricane Katrina, does that mean then that these people that suffer from Hurricane Katrina are Katrinaites or something like that? Would we label them as Katrinaites because they were victims? Now, Christians have a long heritage of a long history of martyrdom. So do the Muslims. But I noticed in the Bible, and I got to looking through the scriptures over here, and I don't find any martyrs. Don't find very many martyrs. I shouldn't say there aren't any, but they're pretty rare. Abraham was not a martyr. He died of old age. And Isaac, he died of old age, and Jacob died of old age. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not die as martyrs for Jesus. Now, throughout the Middle Ages, there were a lot of people that died as martyrs for Christianity. The Catholic Church put them to death. Now, they called themselves Christians. And the Catholic Christians were killing the Protestant Christians because they thought that they were bad Christians, and bad Christians needed to be killed. And the truth of the matter is, none of these Christians, Catholic or Protestant, were practicing the law of God. They did not practice the Passover, the days of unleavened bread, and they did not keep the Sabbath. They were all practicing Sunday. They were all practicing sun worshipers, and you had one gang of practicing sun worshipers killing another gang of practicing sun worshipers in martyrdom. And it goes on today. You see, the Muslims are over there killing Muslims as martyrs, blowing themselves up constantly, and then they don't have anything to do with the Bible, don't have anything to do with the Messiah, who we've already discovered his name is Emmanuel, yet everybody calls him Jesus. What in the hell is that all about? That's why I said a little earlier, has anybody got any reason, logic, or rhyme, or common sense that they could put to this story? Send me an email, let me know. I'd like to see that. I didn't think that that was too newsworthy, but I think this is pretty newsworthy. The word Christian appears in the Bible three times. Not once do we see Christian or Christianity ascribed to any of the apostles. Not a single one of them ever said, Jesus never said, I want you to label our new religion after me and call it Christianity. I want all of you people to know that I'm a Christian and that I'm promoting the church, the Christian church. Now, they talk about the church quite often here in the Scripture. In the Old and New Testament, they talk about the congregation. And the word church in Greek is an ecclesia. It means a group or a called out group of people. And so, you know, you can be a Muslim group of people. You can be a Buddhist group of people. You can be a Christian group of people. You can be a Jewish group of people. You know, you can have all kinds of groups of people over here. But the one thing that I noticed that was lacking here was the Christian group identified by any of the leaders of the New Testament church. Now, they were called Christians. And when one guy said, you know, you almost persuade me to become a Christian or be a Christian, which would lead a lot of people to believe, well, Paul must have been a Christian because Agrippa, you know, was persuaded to be a Christian. But that's not what Paul said, and that's not what the Scripture says. And then when you go back to Isaiah 28, you know, you got to remember that God said, you know, I'm going to speak to you people with stammering lips and another tongue so that you'll stumble, fall backward, be broken and snared and taken, and that's just about what I see is going on. That's my observation. So we got the God that would never do that, but he's the God that said he's going to. Now, you know, in Deuteronomy chapter 28, he's got a lot of statements here. Let's flip back here to Deuteronomy chapter 28. I'm going to read to you a shocking statement in here. And this Advent lady says, well, the God I serve would never do that. I don't know what God would do or not do. This lady probably knows him better than I do because he doesn't talk to me, but other than what I see here in the Scripture, and I'm just a reporter reporting here. But in Deuteronomy 28, about verse 54, there's a story here about cannibalism. So I thought it's just one of many stories. There's a bunch of stories in here. That doesn't start in verse 54. It starts about verse 52. Shall besiege you and all of your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trusted throughout all of your land. And he shall besiege you and all of your gates throughout all of your land which the eternal your God has given you. And you shall eat the fruit of your own body. That's called cannibalism, when you know you're eating your own children. The flesh of your sons and of your daughters which the eternal your God has given to you in the siege and in the straitness wherewith your enemy shall distress you. So that the man that is tender among you and very delicate, his eye shall be evil toward his brother and toward the wife of his bosom, and toward the remnant of his children which he shall leave, so that he will not give to any of them the flesh of his children whom he shall eat, because he has nothing left him in the siege and in the straitness wherewith thine enemy shall distress you in all of your gates. The tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness, her eye shall be evil toward her husband and her bosom, and toward her son and toward her daughter. It always reminded me of these Hollywood starlets. and toward her young one that comes out from between her feet, and toward her children which she shall bear. For she shall eat them for want of all things secretly in the siege and straitness wherewith your enemies shall distress you in all of your gates. If you will not observe to do all of the words of this law that are written in this book, that you may fear the glorious and fearful name of the Eternal your God. Wait a minute here. Did you guys catch that? This is in Deuteronomy 28. This is this lady. Now, remember this Advent lady says, the God I serve would never do that. This is describing a siege. A siege is where you're surrounded by your enemies. And your enemies have their army out here, and they circled your city so that you can't get any supplies in. You know, the trucks, all of the Teamster trucks cannot get through the city gates, and they can't bring you, you know, all of the goods from China that you need. And we've got that very same siege that's just about to be imposed upon us. It's called the balance of payments deficit. Balance of payments deficit. And that's where you get to spending more money than you've got to spend. And we Americans have been spending about $800 billion a year, and we've been producing about $200 billion a year to pay for it. And under normal circumstances, that works out all right. You know, that's where you're borrowing money on your credit card, and that's fine, no problem there. But then when you get your credit card maxed out, which there's a limit here somewhere, I don't know what the Chinese limit is on maxing out our credit with them, but they came over here some years back and they wanted to buy an oil company, and we said, no, you can't buy the oil company. And every time they want to come over here and buy something, we tell them, no, you can't buy that. And one of these days, you know, they're going to get fed up with that. I mean, if they're normal at all. And they're going to say, now listen, you know, you owe us about $1 trillion, and we're going to stop buying your treasury bonds. They've already done that. And so as a result of that, there's going to be hell to pay. And it's called depression. And in the Bible, it's called a siege. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but 50% of the food that we eat here in the United States, of the food that we eat here in the United States, not the food we're exporting, not the soybeans, the corn, and the wheat, of the food we eat here in the United States, half of it comes from outside our borders. Just thought I'd let you know that. Now, that food, half of it coming from outside our borders, is a part of that balance of payments deficit. You know, it's like getting your tomatoes from Hermosillo, Mexico, and your grapes from Chile, and your berries from Guatemala. Just want to let you know that that's not being produced in the San Joaquin Valley any longer. It used to be, but not anymore. And when the siege comes down over here, where they're going to have some shortages of food, and then here's this God. Now, I'm not reporting on the Advent God. I can't speak for him. He'll have to speak for himself. But I just wanted to report to you, this God here in Deuteronomy 28, he tells you very plainly, he says, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you a famine. This famine's going to be so severe that you're going to be eating your own children. So, okay. Now, that's turning the world upside down, because most people can't understand it. They can't grasp that. They're talking about Jesus, you know, sweet Jesus, away in a manger. Jesus, love. They talk about love a lot along with Jesus. You ever heard that? Jesus, they talk a lot about love and Jesus. Jesus, the King of Peace. You ever heard about peace and Jesus? No, they're talking about peace and sending peace on earth. Did you know that Jesus, you know, the Messiah, Emmanuel, well, get his name straight here, is the King of War. He's not the King of Peace at all. Let me show you that. It's over here in Matthew. It's Matthew 10, verse 34. Now remember, Jesus, I'm going to use the word Jesus here because that's the name that all of you people are tuned into. When I say Emmanuel, you know, your eyes all glaze over and you space out on me and you can't grasp it because you don't know who I'm talking about. So let's talk about Jesus. You know this guy Jesus, the guy you go to church? 65% of Americans go to church every Sunday. Do you know that? Well, here in America, it's only 15% in Europe, but here in America, 65%. We're a religious bunch over here. At the very same time that 65% of us are going to church every Sunday, 75% of us are watching heavy-duty pornography on our television sets. I mean, we subscribe to it. 75% of Americans subscribe to the services that bring the two pornographic channels into their homes. So I did a little quick math, and I took 25% away from, you know, 75%. And then I said, well, 25% don't watch pornography then. I'm one of those. I guess I'm a nut. I'm not subscribing to the channels that bring in pornography to my home. So there's 25% of us. Now let's suppose that of the 65% of Christians out there, we take 25% away. And we'll presume that the 25% that don't watch pornography must all be good church-going Christians. So take 25% away from 65, that leaves you with 40, doesn't it? Well, in hell, 40% of Christians are watching pornography, or they're subscribing to hardcore pornography, which is a violation of thou shalt not commit adultery, isn't it? Now, I told you Christians are criminals. Go to church every Sunday, but just because a criminal goes to church every Sunday, if a bank robber goes to church every Sunday, does that make him not a bank robber? If a pedophile goes to church every Sunday, does that mean he's no longer a pedophile? So I just thought I'd point that out to you. All right, well, Jesus said this. He said, think not that I've come to send peace on earth. I've not come to send peace, but sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be those of his own household. And he that loves father or mother more than me isn't worthy of me. He that loves son or daughter more than me isn't worthy of me. And he that takes not his cross and follows after me isn't worthy of me. And he that finds his life shall lose it. He that loses his life for my sake shall find it. Looks like to me that this guy requires that you die, if that's what it comes down to. It says right here, verse 39, he that finds his life shall lose it. And he that loses his life for my sake shall find it. So if you're looking for eternal life, you may have to give up your life. Now, I pointed out that martyrs are very rare here in this program, but this God here requires, if push comes to shove, you got to be willing to give your life. Now, there was a guy named Daniel that was willing to do that. He went into the lion's den. He wasn't killed there, by the way. He survived it. There was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They went into the fiery furnace. They had to be willing to do that. Otherwise, they probably couldn't qualify for eternal life in the first resurrection, but evidently they did, because they were both, or all three of them, were saved alive out of the fiery furnace. So I just want to point that out, that there's lots of Christian martyrs, but there's not very many martyrs in the Bible. Now, there was one guy that was killed early on, and that was John the Baptist. John the Baptist. And except for John the Baptist and the Messiah, you can't find anybody practicing the law of God, practicing the Ten Commandments, that was killed before he was 70 years old, because there's a contractual requirement that if you're practicing the law, you have to live to be 70. 25,550 days. 70 years. 70. I will fulfill all of your days. That's a contractual benefit. There's 33 of these benefits that you get here in the scripture. Now, there is a martyr or two, that people that were killed for their beliefs, but they were killed after they were 70. Or it doesn't tell us how old they were, so I just thought I'd point that out. All right, we're talking about turning the world upside down. Maybe we should name this, we're turning the world right side up. I guess it depends upon how you view the glass. Is it half empty or half full? I'm about out of time. I've got to remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information about that homeschooling program, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.